Your man on the road, he doing promo.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your putanesca of musical contributions. Oh, I'm your host, Ben Ratliff.
Cause you look even better than the photos. I can't find your house, send me the info. Driving through the gated residential. Found out I was coming, sent your friends home.
Today we're talking about The Weeknd.
Dirty Boys are back. Ben Ratliff is back.
What's good, John? It's been
a while.
How was
your time away?
Fantastic. You know where I was?
You were in Berserker Town.
Yeah, well, I was somewhere else too.
Yeah, you were.
Canada.
What? Mm-hmm. What's popping in Canada?
The Weeknd.
Hey!
The Weeknd has a new record, Beauty Behind the Madness.
His second major label album of original material, if we're not counting the trilogy re-release of his mixtapes.
And you've been sort of chasing him
hot
around
on the tail.
Canada and New York.
And L.A.
And
yeah.
L.A.
Yeah.
For months, for a New York Times Magazine piece that came out a few weeks ago.
I mean, if we're really being honest, it's been years, if we're putting it straight.
Started in 2010.
11. Actually. Well, yes. I mean, I guess technically 2010.
But when did you... Let's back up.
Yeah, we want to start at the beginning.
We're talking about Abel Tesfaye.
Yes.
Who is a musician from an Ethiopian family, grew up in Toronto. Mm-hmm.
And Scarborough, just outside Toronto.
And just outside
or
Toronto.
Or in the GTA, for everybody who's going to fact check us.
And in 2010, he started making music, his own songs, mm-hmm. cheaply. And putting it up online.
On YouTube. There were three songs that went up on YouTube in, I think, October of 2010. The original links are not there. They were taken down and reposted maybe in January or February, which is frustrating because you can't get the exact hit count anymore to those original links. But, you know, three songs right off the rip. That started getting attention at the end of 2010, which is when I found them.
Was it the following year that Drake's people reposted them?
It was all in that year.
Right.
I think the songs originally went up in October. I think Drake's people posted them, I want to say, in early December of mm-hmm. 2010, which on the OVO blog, back when the OVO blog was like a blog spot.
Yeah.
They started making the rounds. People obviously got very excited. It's important to remember at this time, it was credible to become like an internet famous person.
Yeah.
But it wasn't necessarily credible to become internet famous and then subsequently actually famous. That narrative hadn't totally really been written, mm-hmm. not in a real way. Mm-hmm. And he did not have his face out there.
I remember the videos were
– they weren't
YouTube
videos.
Things weren't videos. It was just a single shot, black and white.
Debauched party scenes.
Some sort of – somebody lying on the ground.
Yeah, like
in
women
some apartment.
In states of disrobing.
Yeah.
You know, Bacchanal. Basically.
And it was excitingly slow R&B with mm-hmm. this high aching voice.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, it reminded me at the time, you know, I have a lot of affection for screw music and, mm-hmm. and slow Texas rap and stuff like that. It reminded me of when you would hear DJ Screw do R&B records.
Yeah.
And he would slow pitch them down and the voice becomes very otherworldly. You know, it's not Chipmunky, it's a moan, but the voice becomes almost post-human, and the production is murky and sloshy, but also very steady. There was a real steadiness of purpose in those three songs,
mm-hmm.
I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the voice is just something that you just didn't hear.
Yeah.
You didn't hear it in R&B, you didn't hear it in pop, you didn't hear it in rock.
Although it was a funny little slow, sad moment, because that was also the James Blake moment.
You listen to James Blake, and like James Blake is doing math. You know what I mean? You listen to The Weeknd, and The Weeknd is like, that's your art class. You know, James Blake is, there's a clinical aspect to James Blake's music.
Mm.
There's a stiffness to it.
Mm.
And also, whatever,
sounds like a mind-body duality you're laying out here.
I wish it was even a duality. It's not even the same spectrum in my mind.
Right.
Because James, there's a frigidity in something what Blake is doing. And Abel, the other thing that Abel did was lyrically... I mean, this is, you know, we're talking orgies, we're talking drug parties.
The persona is enormous.
Yeah.
It's just like a huge, casts this wide, you know, like haze
over
the whole thing.
So there's this real tension at the time where like, is it super dead-eyed and cold and like lost in a drug haze, or is it actually the most felt stuff ever, and yeah. every nerve ending is alive, but alive with negativity?
Well, what we heard coming in was The Hills.
Yes.
A track from The Weeknd's new record, Beauty Behind the Madness, which I remember hearing at...
You heard at Coachella.
At Coachella.
Yeah.
Didn't know what I was hearing at the time, but it was sort of a moment.
Yeah.
And I started writing down the words. And
you even quoted it in your review about, girl, you look even better than the photos.
Yeah. The voice. Talk about the voice. Analyze the voice for me for a second.
An amateur read would be that it connotes anguish because it's high and it's thin and it's ached.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I listened to him back then and also now, there's so much power in that thin voice mm-hmm. and in that high voice. To me, it feels like a different form of authority. It's right. a different form of strength and clarity. I don't see him as someone who is, especially after having spoken to him a bunch, this isn't a person who's struggling with these decisions. This is a person who's wide-eyed open and going headfirst into whatever the choice is, whether it's a sex orgy, whether it's a drug orgy, any of this stuff. These are clear-headed decisions that he's making.
Well, also, somebody coming from an American pop background would hear that voice and think, oh, Michael Jackson ballad voice.
Well, that too.
But there's other things.
Frankie Lyman.
Well, yeah. Sure. Maybe doo-wop mm-hmm. too or mm-hmm. something like that. What about other things that may have contributed to his voice?
Oh, sure. I mean, when he talks about singing, and this is something he and I spoke about a bunch and I sort of had thought about a bunch prior to speaking with him, there are a couple of component parts that I think are not obvious to the ear. On the one hand, you have basically, for lack of a better way of putting it, a 70s rock tradition. You have Led Zeppelin, you have Queen. You know, he talks about Robert Plant, about imperfections in his voice. He says Robert Plant said made it okay for him to feel like not every note that he was singing was the perfect note or in the perfect representation of the note. And Freddie Mercury talks about a lot also in terms of live stuff, in terms of the band and whatnot and what he wants to be presenting on stage, which we can get to later.
Really?
The other thing, of course, is, you know, Abel, depending if you're in the Ethiopian community or not,
mm-hmm. okay.
Grew up in a household with a mother and a grandmother who spoke Amharic and listened to a tremendous amount of Ethiopian music.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about your Ethiopian jazz of the 60s and mm-hmm. 70s. If you have Ethiopiques compilations, mm-hmm. it's that stuff. And then, of course, Ethiopian pop, 70s, 80s, and 90s. There's a singer named Oster Oweke mm-hmm. who he said when he hears her sing and he hears her runs, he's like, I think that's where I got that from.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So that thin, trembling kind of voice has a whole different set of associations.
Yes, that American
your typical
pop
American listener is just not going to be aware of.
No, and he also talked about when you hear him sing, there's a way that he has power when he goes to the note and then almost like, you know, like sometimes you're at an air show and you see like a plane flying high and then it's like they kill the engine and it kind of like scores back down to
mm-hmm.
earth.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way that he falls back from a note. He like powers up to it and then cuts the engine
mm-hmm.
and falls back. That, he said, he feels has a lot to do with the music that he grew up listening to, the Ethiopian music.
I remember you writing about him. Well, I think you went to see maybe his first major performance.
His first real show after in Guelph, which is near Toronto.
Uh-huh, right.
Yes. Vocals, Ethiopian stuff. And actually, when I was in his apartment in December, we were talking about the Ethiopian pop stuff and talking about what he was listening to when he was growing up in his house. And he was unfamiliar with the Ethiopiques compilations, as I imagine most people of Ethiopian background are because they live
in
them.
They don't need it.
They don't need it. So I said, are you aware of this? And he says, no. So I was like, oh, well, you have iTunes up or Spotify or whatever. Like, let's pull it up. So he pulls up one of the Ethiopiques things, I think, on Spotify and just starts clicking through.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just like, I know that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know that. Like, it's just grammar. In his house, that's just grammar.
So the reason I wanted to ask you about that early performance that you saw was, how was his voice as opposed to how it is now? I remember seeing him at Coachella in 2012. And I don't know what was going on. It could have been monitor problems. Mm-hmm. It could have been throat problems. But he was having trouble.
Well, let's talk about that.
And more recently, I saw him and I thought his singing was very fine.
Yeah, he's a very good, like, we can get that out of the way early. He's a very good singer. Mm-hmm. Technical. He's a very good technical singer. Mm-hmm. He warms up before every show. You know, he's very mindful of the quality of his voice. He's not a trained singer, but he's very mindful of the quality of his voice, and I think he's a good intuitive technical singer.
Right.
All right, so let's do a little backstory. Okay, so those songs go up at the end of 2010. Oliver, who's Drake's now co-manager at the time, just sort of right-hand man, posts the songs. Pretty quickly, things start to happen. Labels call. Publishers call. John Caramonico. Like, everybody calls. Everybody's mm-hmm. trying to find out what's going on. And for a few months, they don't do anything. Abel and his team basically don't – they take some meetings. There's a manager who they used to have who's kind of out of the picture now. It's basically a lot of obfuscation. Mm-hmm. And so for, I would say, almost 6 months, there's a fog. And some A&R guys manage to, like, find a way through and take meetings and label heads and publishing people, a tour person from William Morris. But from a public perspective, all you're seeing is the mixtapes. Mm-hmm. So there's three mixtapes. There's House of Balloons, which includes the early songs and some other ones. Then you're seeing one called Thursday, which is, like, a little bit more emotional, it's a little bit more about a relationship and less about the sort of Dionysian orgies of 2010 Toronto, mm-hmm. Cool Kids. And then the third one is called Echoes of Silence, although really what you see around that same time is that Abel is beginning to collaborate with Drake on Drake's Take Care album. Mm-hmm. So you're starting to see stuff from that trickle out. And in my mind, Take Care, at least the parts that Abel is on, are very much of a piece with those mixtapes. Like, in my mind, it's almost the fourth mixtape.
The Crew?
Crew Love.
Crew Love.
Crew Love, which is, like, one of the signature songs for both men, I think. But the Crew Love is one of three or four songs. I'm not remembering right now. It was either three or four songs that were originally written for House of Balloons.
Uh-huh, right.
That ended up on Drake's Take Care, which is not insignificant.
Crew Love was one of the best songs on that record.
It's a great song.
Yeah.
You can hear how it originally did not have Drake.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And it's not to say Drake does. Actually, that Drake verse on that song is one of my favorite Drake verses on any Drake song. But if you were to...
But it would still be a great song.
It would be
without
a great song without it.
Yeah.
The melody is so sure-footed. The singing is so powerful that if it just cut off right before Drake showed up, you would never think it was missing something.
Right.
So anyway, if you're in the public, all you're seeing is this music, but you're not seeing – he's not giving interviews. I certainly tried. He's not giving interviews. He's not taking photos. Mm-hmm. He's not being out in public. That summer of 2011, he does a one-off show at a place called the Mod Club where he actually performed the other night as sort of like a circle closing mm-hmm. Gesture. You know, it was a big Cool Kid Toronto event. It's the first time he showed his face on stage. And he performed a bunch of those records mm-hmm. from the first two mixtapes. Then he appears at OVO Fest, which is Drake's festival, mm-hmm. does a couple songs with Drake. That's in August, I think. And then he embarks on his first tour. And this is a Canadian tour. This is not an American tour. Mm-hmm. This is, I think, October of 2011. I fly up to Toronto. I get in a car with a photographer. We go to a town called Guelph, mm-hmm. which is maybe 30 to 45 minutes outside Toronto. Guelph seemed kind of like a sleepy kind of college/semi-industrial town, not a lot popping. The show was at basically the equivalent of like an American VFW mm-hmm. hall, mm-hmm. and they had bottle service.
Nice.
Which was hilarious. Because mm-hmm. obviously, and I asked the woman working the merch table, I was like, do you guys do this a lot? Is there like bottle service at this VFW hall in Guelph? And she gave me like a hilarious look. Mm-hmm. And she was like, this is the most fun Guelph's had in like, basically like since I've been an adult. And it was an extremely turned up show. Abel had a bottle of Hennessy in his hand on stage. His hair was still short or relatively short. He didn't have the whole architectural thing happening. He was wearing a baseball cap low. He was not 100% comfortable on stage. The voice was there, but it was much more of a rock show. Mm-hmm. He had a very loud band. He had an amazing female bass player who was like lost to time. Like no one knows where she is. If anybody knows where she is, you should buy all her records or whatever she's doing. She was a monster. Mm-hmm. It was like an R&B rock show, but not kind of like in the 1970s sense, like a modern R&B rock show.
Most people there had never laid eyes on him before.
No. You could have seen clips from the Toronto show on YouTube by that point.
Right.
But no. That was the first time most people had seen him.
Yeah, okay.
And also, it's like, you know, Canada was just getting comfortable having one star.
Yeah.
You know, Drake had been we were 2 years into Drake at that point. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you got a second one.
Right.
People were excited. It was like a beautiful, diverse, young, excited crowd in Guelph. That show, I thought he was really in good voice. Now, not necessarily as clear and as crisp as he is now, but there was a version of him in that 2011 moment where I was like, okay, so he's basically going to front a soul rock band mm-hmm. that's like basically electronic soul rock band. Mm-hmm. And he has attitude and he's running around on stage and he seems uncomfortable, but he's drinking and he's like pouring Hennessy out for people in the crowd. And I was like, okay, this is a new thing. I don't know what this is, but it's interesting and he sounds good and the band is great and okay, cool. Now, you saw him 3 or 4 months, maybe 5 months later at Coachella. Mm. Now, you got to keep in mind a lot of stuff happens in between that Guelph show and Coachella. Mm. He takes on a formal touring agent. He hasn't officially signed his record deal, but he's basically on the verge of signing his record contract. That show, I think, spooked him. I think Coachella spooked him. Mm-hmm. I know he told me, and I'm not sure if this ended up in the piece. I don't think it did. Like, he took a vocal lesson or two to make sure that he was going to be totally prepared. He said he didn't feel like it was working for him. Mm. And when he said he looked back at that Coachella performance, when he looked back at the tape, he said to me straight up, he's like, that kid is not a legend. He knew that it wasn't his best showing. And I think moments like that accrued over the next year or two to ultimately lead to the decision-making to where we are today
interesting.
Of these big songs.
Very interesting. I was ready to actually sort of give up hope after that performance, to be honest.
Sure. Big stage and was not an A+.
Yeah.
One thing that I learned about Abel spending a bunch of time with him, you can't criticize him in a way that he's not criticizing himself. Like, it's not a yes man kind of situation. I think he has people around him who will look at him and just kind of be like, we can do better.
So let's pause and hear another track from the new record, Beauty Behind the Madness, by The Weeknd. Let's hear Prisoner with Lana Del Rey. John, you've spent a fair amount of time with Abel, and you know his family story, and you know about his friends, mm-hmm. and you know about how he grew up. Talk to me about the darkness. The darkness comes first in the Weeknd persona mythos, and it's so thick, and it's so deep.
And so specific.
And so specific. And it's like he cannot take a drink without it being an evil potion. He cannot engage with a woman without it being, you know, like just sort of the most negative, profane act. You know what I'm saying? It's like almost like a literary mm-hmm. device where everything is cast in this kind of like he's exulting, he's great, mm-hmm. he's, you know, he's getting over, but he's sort of a force of evil.
Right.
Right? So what is that about? Where does that come from?
Just a quick sidebar. The profane and the negative are not one and the same in Abel, which is, I think, an important thing to remember.
Okay.
Certainly early on when there wasn't a lot of material and there wasn't a lot of him to kind of like go off of, it was easy to kind of be like, well, the profane and the negative must all be the same.
Mm-hmm.
But over time, I think it becomes clear. You talk about it as like almost like a literary device, the profane qualities. He is truly writing stories that are true, profane, often based in real life experience. But he's not advertising his unhappiness.
No, that's right.
Right.
I completely
and
understand
that. And that is key. That is a key thing to understanding The Weeknd that I think you can't totally get just from listening to the records, especially the early records.
Right.
So, okay. So where does this come from? So, okay. So Abel is 16 years old, 15 years old in high school. He's into music. He meets this guy, Lamar. Lamar's like the other cool kid in his high school. They're in Scarborough. You know, they hang out downtown. You know, they're talking to girls, buying mixtapes, hanging out, mm-hmm. like being wild kids. Mm-hmm. Scarborough, and I got a little bit of flack for this online.
Yes.
Scarborough is kind of dull. It's basically a suburb, and there are parts of it that are nice, and there are parts of it that are not nice. Yep. He grew up in one of the not nice places in yep. Scarborough, mm-hmm. and it's a little dreary. There are people fighting me on Twitter telling me how beautiful Scarborough is. I'm sure your part of Scarborough is beautiful. Mm-hmm. But this part of Scarborough and the part that I went to with Abel, we drove there and drove around, and he showed me his old apartment and the gas station. Like, you know, we saw the spots. This was not beautiful Scarborough where he was. Mm-hmm. He wanted out. And what Abel was always into was he likes film. He likes screenplays. He's into horror. Him and Lamar would make like DIY horror films mm-hmm. in Lamar's house. Mm-hmm. It actually reminds me a little bit when I was talking to them about it. The video, the Earl video, the very first Earl video that basically got him sent to Samoa
mm-hmm. yep.
for that song. It reminded me, what he was describing reminded me a little bit of what that was like when that first arrived. Like weird DIY, like black kids spazzing out, making druggy horror films.
Okay. And I still don't get the connection because that video and the atmosphere of that video is fun in a crazy way.
I'm still getting.
Whereas The Weeknd is about spiritual death.
Isn't it great though?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
But so go.
Basically, the more time they're spending downtown, Abel's realizing, I don't need to be in school. Drops out of school, gets Lamar to drop out of school. They have a friend from downtown named Hailey. They all move into an apartment in Parkdale, which at that time is, you know, it's like a, not like a, but like a Williams, early Williamsburg kind of, for what it's worth. And they basically just start wilding out. Drugs, fights, stealing food from the supermarket, on welfare, getting money to pay the rent. They're basically having like a year of, I wouldn't say spiritual death, but they're basically just wilding for a year. Mm-hmm. And they go pretty deep into drugs. Abel really enjoys drugs at that time, was into it. When I talked to him about addiction, he's like, I never really felt like I was addicted because he's like, I really believed that I could stop. And he's like, there'd be periods where I just didn't do anything mm-hmm. and I felt like I could. And it seems over time that that's generally been true. But he's pretty frank about trying a whole bunch of different stuff. Lamar is pretty frank. He's like, no one was popping MDMA before we were popping MDMA in Toronto. He's like, nothing was happening before we basically, before XO, which is the crew, mm-hmm. basically takes over downtown. Mm-hmm. They're just living a life of we're partying. We're doing drugs. We're hooking up with girls. We wake up the next day. We're partying. We're doing – like that's their life for a while.
Yep.
And at a certain point, Abel's like, I want to start making music. And his first attempts at making music are not about this. They're as a songwriter because he doesn't think he's the guy. He thinks I'll write a song and maybe Chris Brown will record it.
Right.
So he starts making those records. And a few of those things are still floating around on the internet. If you dig around, you can find them. They don't sound like him. I mean, vocally they sound like him, but they don't sound like Weeknd records.
Right.
Eventually he starts writing lyrics about what they're doing, mm-hmm. about these parties. And Abel is an incredibly emotionally astute person. He's a good talker. He's a good listener. And I think he understands the psychodynamics of what's happening in terms of drug use, in terms of sex, in terms of power and relationships and the power dynamic in relationships. Mm. And he starts writing lyrics about that. Eventually, they meet a producer, this guy Jeremy Rose, who produced those first three songs or who co-produced those first three songs. It's like a dark R&B that they come up with mm-hmm. to match these dark lyrics. Mm-hmm. Then eventually, Jeremy Rose gets shunted to the side. Ilangelo and Doc McKinney. Doc McKinney used to work with Estero. Those guys come in. And they basically complete the Weeknd project. And they're the ones who produce the majority of the three mixtapes
yeah.
that are coming.
Yeah.
And Abel keeps writing lyrics about what's happening. He keeps writing lyrics about the dark stuff. To me, that's the stuff that animates him. It's the stuff that excites him. He's also a person who, at that point, doesn't believe that love is for him. All he believes is his life is a series of challenged and questionable decisions one after the next.
Okay, I still don't get it.
Okay.
Because 999 young, aspiring R&B singer songwriters doing all the things that Abel was doing would be writing about those same things and casting them in a different light.
What different light?
Abel is choosing to cast them in a light of, oh, I don't know how you would put it, amorality or something, but he like draws a circle around it as if it's a philosophical system. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like he knows exactly what he's doing.
But you're just basically asking like, why is a dog like a dog? It's like Abel is like Abel because that's what he brought into the situation.
Okay.
You know, he's not a James Fauntleroy. He's not a Chris Pratt.
Right.
This is where him being outside the system kind of works to his advantage.
Okay.
He's not in L.A. trying to make
right.
hits.
That's right.
He's not in Miami.
Yeah.
He's not coming from an R&B tradition. Who does he like? He likes Michael Jackson. He likes Freddie Mercury. He likes people who are not the people who are on the radio at that moment. And when you hear those songs that he wrote that are radio songs and they're failures, you understand why.
Yeah.
Because all he wants to do is think this other way.
Let me ask you a question now that I think slots in basically to where we are on the timeline.
Okay.
In your story, you talk about how he gets a job at American Apparel.
Oh, yeah.
And that's after the time that he starts making his own songs.
Yes.
And singing them himself.
Yes.
Right? So
this is roughly the end of 2010.
So it's the end of his total waster period, marginal lifestyle waster period.
It's not the end of it, but it's the beginning of the end of it.
I don't think
he gave up on that right away. Yeah. It wasn't like a light switch that went off.
In your piece, you say that, you know, these songs were maybe making the rounds locally.
Yes, they were posting them originally on, like, Lamar's friends' Facebook walls, which mm-hmm. is, like, a thing you did in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Abel did have a Facebook page, but they took it down because they realized that the secrecy was, like, actually a good thing for them.
Yeah.
So they removed his Facebook page. So people eventually found out his name, but no one knew what he looked like.
Sometimes the songs would come on in the store.
Yeah.
Somebody, whoever was in charge of the mm-hmm. sound system in American Apparel, mm-hmm. would play one of his songs on the system.
Correct.
And there he was folding T-shirts.
Yes.
But he did not say anything.
No.
Why didn't he say anything?
Well, one, it's also possible that his manager was the one playing the records because his manager at American Apparel ends up being a guy who designs the original Weekend logo, which is something that's not in the story.
Ah, okay, that makes some more sense.
So that could be part of it. I mean, I think his coworkers didn't know, but, you know, his manager ends up being in on the gig, kind of. Here's a guy who is not totally comfortable with approbation, with public scrutiny. He's living basically a nocturnal life of questionable decisions.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, in like a month, everybody is trying to figure out who he is.
Mm-hmm.
And he has remained purposefully obscure. I think at that moment, he didn't feel comfortable stepping into the role of being the Weeknd.
Mm-hmm.
I think he assumed he would have 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, whatever, that he would have a window of protection before he had to step up and be the guy.
Did he actually like the idea of anonymity? You know, I mean, I wonder if you talked to him about this, like the idea of, you know, being Thomas Pynchon or whatever, living life that way.
Yes. I think they realized that that was probably not tenable long term.
Right.
If I have it correct, initially, I don't think that was 100% the goal. But I think once they realized that anonymity played to their advantage.
And anonymity may be the wrong word, whatever.
No, I mean.
Not showing your face
yeah,
in public.
Whatever it was. I don't think that was the going in the door goal.
Mm-hmm.
I think if a couple of things had happened differently right around October 2010,
yeah.
he'd be on Universal Canada and there'd be a press shot of him. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was totally comfortable. Even when he started posing for photos, he would only pose for photos taken by his crew. He didn't feel like he could step out into the spotlight because he was like, look, I didn't feel comfortable with the way I looked. I didn't feel comfortable with the person I was. I wasn't ready to be a guy out here talking about myself, showing off, and having flashes go off in my face.
So something just occurred to me. What we're talking about is, you know, his nocturnal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
He is expressing it as control rather than lack of control, as wild as they get. Right?
Oh, his songs are about power.
They're about power and control.
God. Totally about
never
power.
About losing control.
No.
Even at his most, you know, drugged out state.
No, if anything.
It's like in that song, The Hills, where he says, when I'm whatever, when I'm under the influence, that's the real me.
Power and drugs at that time are not divorceable.
Right.
Like the drugged out self, like you say, the drugged out self is the powerful self. He's not sort of suggesting that, like, I give in to the drugs and then things happen to me.
Yeah.
It's the opposite. I give in to the drugs and I make things happen.
Mm-hmm.
All these stories that I'm telling, I steered those stories.
Right.
I did those things.
Yep.
I mean, you talk about, like, dark and you talk about sort of moral cancer or whatnot. Like, all these sort of things that were thrown around early Weeknd songs.
Mm-hmm.
That's what got people sort of angsty, I think, is mm-hmm. – there's no apology in these records.
Right.
These are records that bathe and celebrate what it's like to be living that lifestyle and making those choices very deliberately, what we would think of as quote-unquote bad choices.
Right.
But at the same time, that anti-moral stance was one of the most exciting things I'd heard musically in like quite some time. I mean, is it about death? Absolutely, it's about death. Is it about the failures of intimacy and connection? Of course it is. But it's also it's like divine. It's transcendent. I mean, it's emotionally accurate in a way that typical pop or R&B or whatever avoids some of the specificity, even on a positive side. He's like, not only do I not subscribe to this vagueness that's going on in music, I also don't subscribe to the general tenor of optimism.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to be extraordinarily detailed about the worst possible things.
Right.
And as a listener, it made me immediately stand up and pay attention. And I think a lot of other people too. And I think he earned a lot of fans because of that willingness to go in that other direction.
Right.
And he became very famous for a guy who basically never had a radio hit. I mean, I call him in the piece a no-hit wonder. I mean, he sold out the Barclays Center with no hits.
Right.
I mean, that's 15,000 people. The Hollywood Bowl, '02, no hits.
So he makes a first album.
Kissland.
And you have in your piece a very funny quote by a record executive. I forget who it is.
It's
who says, here, Abel is sort of stepping up and saying, I'm ready to play ball. But on the first album, it was as if he were playing ball with a plate of spaghetti.
Isn't that an amazing quote?
It's fantastic.
It's Dahila, who is his sort of like producer slash engineer. He's like he's the guy who's always with Abel in the studio for whatever. Like, you know, sometimes it's on the board, sometimes it's not.
And he said that in contradistinction to the new album where he's like, nah, this time he's actually got, you know, the Louisville Slugger.
Yeah. But a plate of spaghetti.
It was funny when he said that because I was like, sir, I like spaghetti. You know, like I felt, you know. I mean, the next thing I want to get to with you is, okay, here's this guy with unbelievable willpower. He knows how to create his own reality. He's got the purple crayon.
Yeah,
and, he does. And he's like...
Good one.
And he's like, well, we were talking about...
purple crayons for my haters.
We were talking about how it's almost like a literary device. It's specifically like... you know, the famous amoral French novel, Against the Grain.
Is that Houellebecq?
No. J.K. Huysmans.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So...
he's kind of like a Houellebecq kind of guy, Abel is.
Yeah?
Yeah. Kind of like a Houellebecq guy. Okay.
Okay.
Noted. So, noted.
I'm just thinking Abel wants to write the dark 8-minute songs. You know, he wants to do things his own way. And then at a certain point, he gives in. I mean, he gets over, but he gives in.
But can we talk about spaghetti first? Before we talk about the Louisville Slugger, let's talk about spaghetti for a minute.
Yeah.
You know, spaghetti's delicious.
Yes.
I like spaghetti.
Sure.
I know you don't like Vincent's where I go. Mm. I know you don't like it, but I like Vincent's. Mm. They have great sweet sauce.
Yeah.
The fried shrimp on that, it's delicious. Also, shouts to Dahila for that interview. The amount of gems in that interview, just FYI, off the chart gems. I only was able to use just the one, but just off the chart gems. What a beautiful spiritual man who just really went in with me. So shouts to him.
So The Hills, to take an example, The Hills for me feels like the end of spaghetti.
Yes. So you know what I mean? It's funny you're talking about The Hills that way because that is, in my mind, the song on the new album that is it's the half and half. It's the I'm getting the old thing out of my system, but I'm letting you know about the new thing.
Yeah.
Kissland really is kind of an extension of the mixtapes.
Mm-hmm.
He records and writes mostly on tour.
Mm.
It's sort of a fantastical, almost spastic record. There's 7-minute songs on there. It's basically the steroidal version of the mixtapes. It's glossier. Mm. It's bigger. There's more production value behind it. There's more studio time. Like, there's more of everything. And yet it's basically, in principle, the same thing. Then it didn't do that well.
Mm-hmm.
On a commercial level, it didn't do that well.
Yeah.
He's still selling out arenas, but it left him roughly at the same level. You know, there's a ceiling, some kind of glass ceiling. And he's seeing that, like, okay, if I make these kinds of records, this is maybe all it is. Now, all it is
pretty
is...
a decent ceiling, I must
say. Well, that's the thing.
I mean, he could continue to refine that thing, you know...
You can almost become a jam.
Forever.
In a weird way, you become the Grateful Dead. You become fish. Like, you become a jam band. Like, you can sell Madison Square Garden out once a year working within this framework.
Why isn't he happy with that?
I think what happens is, as all this is happening, he's becoming more comfortable. He's more of an adult. He's matured. He's growing up and seeing different things. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I'm not scared anymore. I'm not scared to be in the spotlight. I'm not scared to be a guy who is idolized by people. I'm not scared to be a guy who is friendly and collaborates with other musicians. Abel's different. Mm-hmm. And he starts singing like, well, okay, I've worked so hard and I have these, I don't know, million fans, say. Say you have a million fans for the internet stuff, right? And he's like, there's 5 billion people out there. Why would I only have these million fans? I'm a good songwriter. I'm smart. Like, I'm a talented guy. I can have more. Mm-hmm. What's it going to take for me to have more? He goes to the label and he's like, I think I want more. And Wendy Goldstein's a OG A&R executive from the 90s. She worked with the Roots in the night. Like, she's been around for a long time. Very good relationships, a lot of stuff. Wendy, Nate Albert, who's the guy who signed him, they're all having these conversations. And they're like, okay, we can help. Mm. This is where being on a label actually matters in 2015. Because mm-hmm. Abel could have done anything that he did up until Kissland, including Kissland, without a label. Mm-hmm. He didn't need them. What he does need a label for is put me on an Ariana Grande record.
Yeah.
What he does need a label for is get me in a room with Max Martin.
Right.
Now, could he have done that over time by himself? Yeah, but it would have taken much longer. So they put him on this Ariana Grande record.
It's so funny. As if time matters in the Weekend world.
That's very true.
I mean, why should it matter?
It's a warped concept.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter at all. Mm-hmm. And yet, there was an urgency. I think he felt like, I've hit a ceiling at Kissland. I don't want to make Kissland 2. So he goes on this Ariana Grande record, Love Me Harder. I feel like we should listen to a minute of Love Me Harder, because it's worth listening to.
Let's just hear a minute of it.
Then take this pleasure and take it with the pain. And if in the moment you bite your lip, when I get you moaning, you know it's real. Can you feel the pressure between your hips? I'll make it feel like the first time. Cause if you want to keep me, you gotta love me harder. I'ma love you harder.
Okay, so Love Me Harder is, when I first heard that, I heard that in the context of Ariana's album. I didn't know that Abel was on that record, and I hadn't dived into this piece yet. So the story behind that is, there's all this back channel conversation. Ariana's also on Abel's label. They have this record. Max Martin and his team have delivered this record. It's a duet. Ariana has recorded her part, and there's this fill-in verse for what Abel's supposed to do. And they send it to him. And he's like, I can't do this. The lyrics are written already. They're soft. They're not me. They don't sound like a Weekend record.
Right.
This isn't for me. Maybe this is wrong. Like, maybe I've made the wrong choice. And he's like, well, all right. I'm going to rewrite the verse. I'll rewrite it. And I'll record it. And I'll send it back. And if they like it, then cool. Mm-hmm. Then I've written my verse. And if they don't like it, well, then I know it wasn't for me anyway. Mm-hmm. He does. Rewrites it. Records it. Sends it back. They love it. And they use it.
Do you imagine this is the sort of thing that does not happen very often?
With Max Martin's people?
Yeah.
Oh, I think this never happens with Max Martin. I was able to talk to Sabin, who is one of Max's main guys, one of his main songwriting guys. And Sabin was pretty straightforward. There's a part in the piece that got cut talking about the experience of what everybody working together and like what the whole timeline of everything and how unique it was. And Sam was basically like, yeah, people basically show up and sing. He's like, we have a thing. Like, we're the team. We write the melodies. We write the hooks, the pre-chorus, the chord, the bridge, the whole thing. And the label sends us a person, and they say, here's your song.
And there's no space for rewriting. There's no space.
Not generally, yeah. No. Mm-hmm. No. And he's like, what Abel did with us was unlike what we've done with anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I imagine that's not true. I imagine Taylor had a similarly different process, but that didn't come up in this conversation.
Right.
They also underscored something that you just touched on. When Abel played the Hollywood Bowl, this is in, I think, 2013, around the time he played the Barclays Center, mm-hmm. they all went. This is when they're just getting to know each other. It's like very early in the process, maybe even before Abel had gone into the studio. Max, from best I understood, was not totally clued in to how big the weekend was.
Yeah.
So Max, Savin, a bunch of other guys from the camp go to the Hollywood Bowl show. And apparently they're all just like heads exploding because – not because it's an amazing show. I mean, I'm sure it was, but like not because of that. But because I don't think any of them realized here's a guy who is already playing to 10 to 15,000 people on his own thing. I think they were just like, well, here's a guy on a label like that maybe we're going to work with. And apparently – and this unfortunately got cut, but I'll share it here. What Max turns to Savin and says is like, do you know how – important it is that this guy has this, like pointing at everything already, and now is coming to us? Because usually people come to us because they want this.
Right.
This is what they're striving for.
Right.
This guy has this. So it's important that we do something different. And also, it's a risk. Like, no one's no one really talks about it being a risk.
So they were in a position of wanting to please him.
Which is not the position that they are usually in.
Right.
And also, when he first shows up, they just sort of say, like, okay, well, here's a bunch of stuff we've worked on. You can have any of it.
Right.
And he's like, nah, I don't like any of that. We got to start from scratch. So anything that you hear on the record that's coming from Abel and Max's team was basically started from scratch.
Yeah.
And that's something, and again, Savin said at the end, he's like, now people are coming to us and saying we want basically the Abel treatment. Like, that's, we don't want the other thing. He's like, we're taking calls, and he wouldn't say who, but he's like, much more established, famous people are going to come to us now and have been calling because they want that. They don't want Max Martin 1.0. They want Max Martin 2.0. And that's really striking that Abel, just by sort of sheer willpower, was able to kind of like take this titanic of a boat and steer it in a direction that worked for him.
So here's a new record with very explicit hooks and choruses, the kinds of things that Abel didn't used to do.
Or if he did, they were very buried in the mix. It's like, I think when you – I listened to the early mixtapes again after listening to the new album, and a lot of the stuff's there. It's just not underscored in any way. It's murked.
So maybe we should hear an example of this kind of new song, of new weekend song.
To me, the emblematic one, I mean, obviously Can't Feel My Face is a number one song, and that's the one that people, I think, will most identify with this moment in Abel's career. But to me, the record that really jumps out and jumped out when I first heard it, I mean, literally back in November, is called In the Night.
So that was In the Night from Beauty Behind the Madness by The Weeknd.
These songs, he's been working on, and some of them for more than a year. Some of them are very new. A couple of songs that made the final record, I didn't hear even as recently as 2 months ago or 6 to 8 weeks ago. In the Night was something that came from the first Max Martin session, or one of the first. I'm pretty sure the first Max Martin session. And I heard it the night of the American Music Awards, which I had been following him. This is the opening scene of my story, is him at the American Music Awards. And then we went to a studio, and he had recently been in the studio with Max for a few sessions. And this was the first complete song that came out. And we're in there, and this scene is in the story briefly with the head of his publishing company, this guy Ron Perry, real good music ear, real sharp guy. And we're in the studio, and the speakers are blasting, and this song comes on. Ron Perry just starts screaming, like, it's Billie Jean. It's Billie Effin' Jean. And it kind of is. I just remember thinking, oh, well, if the whole record sounds like this, then it's a big old sloppy smash. Like, this is just huge. And he has the voice to pull it off, and clearly the ambition to think that he can pull it off. And it was an interesting moment as someone who'd been familiar with his music for a long time. And the almost willful smallness and reluctance of the music to hear something that was just sort of so unabashed. And In the Night remains sort of one of my favorite records. And it's basically about a woman who gets abused by her father, I guess, in theory, and then is a stripper and sing, dances to the same song that the father would play when, you know, it's dark, but it's sort of, it's like a beautiful, clean, optimistic song. I don't know. There's a lot of joy in that record. And that tension between the dark subject matter and the joy and the arrangement is weirdly not that different from the force on the old records that are basically saying, I'm doing all this dark stuff, but I'm doing it with authority and I'm doing it with purpose.
Yeah.
Those aren't joyful records, but they are direct records. This is similar to that, but there's sort of like a top layer of ecstasy that's been like slapped upon it. I think that's why In the Night and Can't Feel My Face and these sort of big Max Martin records don't necessarily feel like they're not of a piece with older Abel records.
Yeah.
To me, at least.
Yeah.
There are other songs on the album that are much more obviously of a piece with older Weekend records, but even these sort of big gleaming records, that there's a tension in them that feels familiar to me from previous projects.
Well, the only trouble I have with the new record, which is a really interesting album as a whole, is that, you know, in the earlier stuff, he had this musical persona and he had this input that came from him. It was his own thing. I don't know what he was listening to. Dream pop, goth, dark ambient.
Yeah.
No idea.
Right.
Beach House.
VNV Nation. Like
perhaps. Yeah. Susie and the Banshees.
Yeah, of course.
But now it's all about hooks and choruses. It's all about there's some part of him, some essential part of him that I worry is just going to be pushed out a little too
much. But you
don't
hear it at all on the record?
I heard yes, places on the record, yes. But I also hear it going away.
Yes.
And I wonder if there's going to be something that comes from him and not from the hit-making machinery that is going to replace it.
Like, okay. We've talked about Michael Jackson, but we haven't talked about Prince. If we swapped out every mention of Michael Jackson in this conversation and also in my piece and swapped in Prince, would we be thinking about it differently? Because I think you could make that case. Prince is poppy but complicated, you know, textured but ambitious, you know, gleaming but dark. We don't ever sort of say like, well, Prince is conceding to hit-making impulses and da-da-da. We don't generally say that about Prince. Mm. What if Abel is doing a Prince thing and not a Michael Jackson thing? If that's the case, do we feel better about the choices?
Yeah, I don't know. Wait and see.
I mean, but there are other songs on the record that feel very old Abel.
Those are the ones I like.
Yeah, Dark Times, the Ed Sheeran record, to me feels very old Abel, Often, which obviously was a hit kind of in between. That feels like an old Abel record. I think the thing that's coming through, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, you were like, well, why is he like this? Mm-hmm. Why is he making these records? What's going on in his head? Mm-hmm. Now you have to ask the same question about why is he like this in 2015? He grew up. He maybe is in love. This is a thing that, you know, I've been talking to him over many months, and like as recently as the end of last year, the end of 2014, he was basically like, yeah, I'm not trying to fall in love. Like that'd be bad. He's like, you listen to my records. He's like, that'd be like death for me.
Mm-hmm.
And yet,
his magic power would go away.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I sort of equated it to Samson a little bit, you know, and he may be in love. Like he wouldn't talk about it directly, but if you sort of read the tabloids and you sort of follow online what's happening, there's a woman named Bella Hadid who's a young model. She's 19 or 20 now, not sure. I saw them together. You know, it's in the story. I saw them together. I can't put a name on whatever they are. Whatever they are is whatever they are.
Yeah.
But clearly, something's been happening in the last, say, 4 to 6 months that has fundamentally altered his relationship to hope and to optimism and to love.
Yeah.
And what you hear on this record, and he was very, very careful. When I saw him last in either April or May, I can't remember. I think it was the end of April. He was very, very preoccupied with the sequencing of the record, which to me is like a very 70s or 80s thing to care about. Like in 2015, like I don't think Trey Songz is like agonizing. No shots to Trey Songz, who I like. I don't think Trey Songz is agonizing over sequencing of his album. You know what I mean?
This is because Abel is telling a story.
Beginning to end. And so if you listen to the beginning of the record, you listen to Real Life, you listen to Tell Your Friends, you listen to Often in the Hills – a lot of that is skeptical, old Abel, making bad decisions. The Hills, to me, is a transition point. It's coming out of the old thing and potentially into a new thing. And even Tell Your Friends, that song, which is very much Abel rap singing about like what he's going through, I don't know if you've seen the video for Tell Your Friends, but yes. He's literally burying his old self.
Right.
He's singing the first verse, head in a plastic bag, and is digging, another Abel is digging dirt onto that guy. Mm-hmm. So that he's killing that guy. Mm-hmm. And then is all of a sudden, he's standing tall, he's wearing a cool trench coat, and he's doing a Michael Jackson dance move mm-hmm. out in the desert or whatever. The middle, Acquainted, Can't Feel My Face, these are the records that are sort of like staring the possibility of love in the face, in my mind. Mm-hmm. It's basically like, I'm testing myself. And then Can't Feel My Face is like, it's a drug record, but it's also about love. Mm-hmm. Earned It is sort of like the arrived. It's like the you're special. I'm willing to give myself to you. You're special. And then towards the end, again, it's calling into question which part of him is going to win. Angel, Dark Times, Prisoner, like these are all tug of war songs.
Right.
About what's going to happen. When I listen to this, you say, well, I don't hear that old Abel. And what I say is I hear the old Abel sort of at war with new experience.
Right.
And trying to figure out how to process it and put it in a song form.
Well, if he is going to fall in love, which seems possible,
I mean,
he's going to have to figure out a way to present himself as unconventionally in love. I can easily see him figuring out a way to protect his identity as a solitary, mysterious person and be somebody who's in love.
I think that's probably what he's working towards. I mean, I think basically if you listen to Acquainted on this record, a lot of the songs on this record have long outros. Like he's there, he hasn't totally gotten rid of the thing like where I want to make a 5.5 minute song or a 6 minute song.
Right. There's still some spaghetti on the table.
There's some spaghetti. Absolutely. and that song in particular, Acquainted, if I have this correct, and I'm pretty sure I do, the outro is a sort of like vocal kind of like curlicues about girls born in the 90s. Yep. And if I'm remembering this correctly, that was the song. The song was Girls Born in the 90s, and it was darker, and it was much more skeptical.
Get me the bootleg.
What he basically said was, I didn't feel like I could stand by that song because I've changed and I've grown. So I basically wove that idea into Acquainted, which is like a slightly more – it's not a totally optimistic song, but it's a song that's about the possibility of something happening as opposed to being skeptical about the person who's trying to make you fall in love. So you see that that's what the tension on this record is. And from a songwriting perspective, like I can't see Abel writing songs for other people. I'm sure he's been asked, and maybe he even has from time to time. And obviously in the Drake context, he's given songs to Drake. But he's a guy who basically is writing as he goes. And I think he abandoned a whole bunch of records from 2014 and late 2013 because they just didn't make sense to him anymore. Mm-hmm. And so this is what we're left with. And obviously – whatever he goes through in the next 12 months, that's what the next thing will be.
So let's do something that Abel wouldn't like. Let's go out with the first song
Real Life
on the record.
And just one thing about Real Life before we play, there's the line on this record that really jumps out to me is, you know, Mama called me destructive, said it'd ruin me one day. You know, like his mother is a real spectral presence on this record because on at least three songs, I think, there are lines about his mom basically saying, you're lost. Like you're not letting love in your life. You're making bad decisions. And obviously he's a mama's boy. You know, he cares a tremendous amount about his mom, doesn't really know his father. And I like how in essence, like the second half of this record is almost like an answer to his mother.
I love the line in your piece about how, you know, when he's leaving the apartment where he lives with his mom, he's carrying the mattress out the door, and he's going to like put it in his friend's car.
What
a van! He says the expression on my mother's eyes. The expression on my mother's eyes. I'm like, you know, those eyes are an important part of his songs.
They
you
are.
Know, I feel like those are my eyes actually. When I'm listening to a lot of his songs, you know what I mean?
Uh huh. I like that he's answering his mother within the context of this record.
Yeah.
And the mother is sort of a scolding figure, a loving scolding figure, not an angry scolding figure, but loving. Like, Abel, I see what you're doing with your life, and who's going to love you?
Yeah.
Who are you going to love? Right. But the thing that's constant is Abel has this unconditional love for his mother, and weirdly, towards the end of the record, he is learning how to transfer that capacity for unconditional love onto another person who's not his mother, which is, if you allow it, is beautiful.
John, thank you for allowing this conversation to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Real love, I know you don't really understand it. I'm not allowed to regret my choice. I heard that love is a risk worth taking. I would, you know, never be that boy. Mama called me destructive.
That's our show. Thank you for listening. Our producers were Tamara Best and Jocelyn Gonzalez. You can read John Caramonica's piece, Profile, that appeared in the New York Times Magazine about The Weeknd, a.k.a. Abel Tesfaye, at nytimes.com/music. Our Spotify playlist will have tracks from The Weeknd, perhaps as well as Astor Awake.
Yes.
And we'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.